Welcome everyone to Isabel's talk. Isabel is now a postdoc at KITP Santa Barbara. She got her PhD from the University of Oxford in 2018. And over her, well, her for this very short career, she was actually worked on a variety of topics of astroparticle physics, beyond the standard model physics, model building, as well as several topics in the interface of more phenomenological aspects to more formal field theory problems. So, and I think she will combine this, she will explain this better in her talk. So Isabel, welcome and take it away.
Thank you, Mina, for the very nice introduction. And thank you for the opportunity to let me tell you a little bit about my research today. So the title of my talk is A Strategy for Progress in Particle Physics. And my goal is to convince you that this is an exciting time to be looking for physics beyond the standard model. So let's start from where we are now. On the one hand, we have a theory of subatomic physics, which is the standard model. Its building blocks include a number of matter fields like quarks and leptons, as well as a number of spin one particles acting as force carriers. So these are the gluons responsible for mediating the strong force, W and Z bosons for the weak interactions, and then of course the photon responsible for electromagnetism. Then finally, the most recently discovered member of the standard model is the Higgs, which plays a crucial role in the dynamics of the theory, as I will discuss more later. So the structure of the standard model is far from random. Interactions among all these different fields are constrained by the underlying symmetry of the standard model, which is the gauge group SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. On the other hand, we also have a theory of gravity, which is Einstein's theory of general relativity. And in short, what GR tells us is that the geometry of the spacetime where all these particles propagate is determined self-consistently by the properties of the matter sector itself. So with these two building blocks, we are capable of describing nature from length scales on the order of 10 to the minus 19 meters, which are the scales that are currently being probed by the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, all the way up to the size of the observable universe. So that is 45 orders of magnitude of success for our theories. However, although the standard model provides an excellent parametrization of subatomic physics, we also know that it is incomplete. And we know that because there are a number of phenomena in nature that cannot be explained by the standard model. So, for example, the dark matter that we observe in the universe, there is five times more dark matter than baryonic matter. That cannot be explained within the standard model. The fact that neutrinos are massive is an observation that directly contradicts the predictions of the standard model. The matter-antimatter asymmetry, so the fact that our universe seems to be made only of matter and no antimatter, is something that, again, we cannot explain. The so-called strong CP problem that I'll talk more about later. So this refers to the very special boundary condition we need to impose on the vacuum angle of the QCD sector, 10 orders of magnitude below our naive expectations, in order to accommodate the fact that we haven't observed an electric dipole moment for the neutron. And finally, one of the biggest mysteries remains our lack of understanding for the dynamics behind the weak scale. So I told you earlier that interactions in the standard model are governed by its underlying symmetry group, but it turns out that the symmetry of the theory is not a symmetry of the vacuum in which we live. In particular, the electroweak subgroup of the standard model is broken down to the only unbroken gauge factor that we've seen in nature, which is electromagnetism. So how much this symmetry is broken, the size of the corresponding order parameter, that is what we call the weak scale. So how this process takes place and why the corresponding order parameter is of the observed size, this remains one of the most fundamental problems in particle physics. So this is by no means a complete list, but the bottom line is that there are a variety of observations that together make for a compelling argument that the standard model is incomplete. And the challenge is for us to come up with solutions to these various problems in ways that we can prove experimentally. Now, these are hard problems that have been around for a long time, and there has been brilliant work in this respect by previous generations of physicists over the last few decades, but so far at least, none of their suggestions seem to be realized in nature. Moreover, even though it is true that all of these puzzles together make for a compelling case in favor of physics beyond the standard model, they don't really give us unambiguous guidance as to where that new physics is going to appear or how we should go look for it. So my talk is going to be about what in my mind is a right strategy to follow in our attempt to discover the more fundamental theory that underlies the standard model. There are three different aspects to it that I am going to discuss during this talk. First, that in order to make progress, we might need to revisit some of our old assumptions in light of current theoretical developments. Second, that exploring connections between the different puzzles may provide us with the guidance that we currently lack. And finally, that it is crucial that we make use of the huge number of different experiments that we have at our disposal to put those ideas to the test. And I am going to illustrate this discussion in the context of what I think are the most pressing problems of the standard model, starting with the dynamics behind the weak scale, moving on to dark matter, and finishing with the strong CP problem. So let's move on to the first part of my talk, revisit old assumptions. So first of all, what are our old assumptions? So there is an idea or a way of thinking that underlies the majority of the work that has been done in trying to address all of these problems, and that is that the paradigm of effective field theory is the right tool to approach these puzzles. Now, there are very good reasons for this. Effective field theory has been a very powerful tool for us to understand the dynamics of quantum field theories, from the features of second order phase transitions all the way to the Carroll Lagrangian of QCD. So in short, EFT is a framework that allows us to organize a theory in terms of the relevant energy scales. And central to this framework is the concept of decoupling. So this is the intuition that our ability to describe the behavior of a physical system in the far infrared, so at very large wavelengths, should be largely independent of the detailed features of the system at very short distances, so in the UV. And this idea of decoupling is precisely what's behind, for example, the universality behavior that we see in systems that undergo second order phase transitions. So by definition, an effective field theory is only valid up to some finite energy scale, lambda. Beyond this cutoff scale, the theory needs to be embedded, or what we call UV-completed, into a more fundamental theory. But if we are looking at the system at energy scales that are well below the cutoff, then the details of the UV-completion should not be very important. So let's look at an example of this. Let's say we're interested in the IR behavior of electromagnetism, so QED with a single fermion, psi, that has mass little m and electric charge G. So in the effective Lagrangian describing the system, we'll write down operators corresponding to the kinetic energies for both the electromagnetic field and the fermion. Also an interaction between the photon and the fermion current, as well as a mass term for psi. And then, consistent with all the symmetries, we should also include an infinite series of higher dimensional operators suppressed by the appropriate power of the cutoff scale beyond which this theory requires an extension. Now, this cutoff scale could correspond, for example, to the mass of some other fermion that is much heavier than this guy. At the very least, this system needs to be coupled to gravity at the Planck scale, in which case lambda could be of order m Planck. Now, these higher dimensional operators are precisely the operators that encode the details of the UV completion, and they are what we call irrelevant. And we call them irrelevant because as we evolve the theory from the UV to the IR, their effects become less and less important. So their effects are on the order of the ratio between the IR and the UV scale to the sum positive power. So very, very tiny, so long as the infrared scale is well below the cutoff. So indeed, as I advertised earlier, UV effects decouple from IR dynamics. So at low energies, we can just ignore the effect of all of these higher dimensional operators, and then our effective field theory is just characterized by only two parameters, which are the mass and the charge of our fermion. And in principle, we are free to consider any value of those parameters as long as they define a consistent effective field theory. So long as the mass of our fermion is below the cutoff and that the gauge coupling remains perturbative. So every point in this orange region would correspond to a perfectly legitimate effective field theory. What happens if we repeat this exercise with a scalar field? So let's consider a single complex scalar that interacts with itself. So again, in the effective Lagrangian, we will write down a kinetic term for phi, a mass term, and also a quantic interaction with a strength that I am going to call lambda. And again, as before, an infinite series of higher dimensional operators suppressed by some power of the cutoff. So as before, this cutoff scale lambda could correspond to the mass of some new particles that interact with phi, but that are much heavier. And just as before, their effect at low energies will be very small. So again, we can safely ignore these operators, and the EFT will again have just two parameters, in this case, the mass and the quartic of this scalar field. Now, there is a subtlety with this, which is that if there are new particles whose mass is of order lambda that interact with our light scalar field with some interaction strength that I am going to call alpha, then these new degrees of freedom lead to a correction to the mass of our scalar field at low energies that it's given by this expression. In particular, it is proportional to the mass of these heavy new particles, okay? So the mass square parameter of a scalar field in an effective field theory is quadratically sensitive to whatever is going on in the UV. This means that for us to even be able to talk about an effective field theory that contains a very light scalar field, the properties of the UV theory need to be such that either all additional heavy degrees of freedom only interact extremely weakly with our light scalar, or that the UV boundary value of this mass square parameter is extremely fine-tuned so as to cancel every single dynamical contribution from physical degrees of freedom as we move from the UV to the IR, or that the UV theory has some additional symmetry that is not apparent at low energies that forbids this kind of corrections. Either way, the point is that an effective field theory that contains a very light scalar is a very special, very non-generic situation, but also exciting because it clearly contains some information about the properties of the UV completion. And it turns out that this is precisely the situation we're in. The standard model appears to be an effective field theory that contains a very light scalar, which is the Higgs. So in the standard model, the mass square parameter of the Higgs is negative. This makes the Higgs get a non-zero vacuum expectation value that, as I said earlier, spontaneously breaks the electroweak symmetry of the standard model down to electromagnetism. So the value of this symmetry breaking order parameter is what we call the weak scale. And we've measured this to be on the order of around 100 GeV. So indeed, much smaller than any other scale at which we suspect the standard model stops working as an effective field theory, in particular, much smaller than the Planck scale. So just as before, our options to reconcile this situation with the expectations of effective field theory are one, that absolutely nothing above the weak scale interacts with the standard model with any appreciable strength. This is extremely hard to believe, given that the various problems of the standard model generically require new dynamics that interact with the standard model, especially the need for a dynamical mechanism behind spontaneous symmetry breaking. Two, that the UV parameters of the scalar sector are extremely fine-tuned, or finally, that the standard model itself breaks down at the scales that are not far above the weak scale, so in the TEV regime, and that the UV completion that appears is such that it introduces some additional symmetry that protects the mass square of the Higgs from getting additional corrections from UV dynamics. And I think it is no exaggeration to say that this third possibility has been the starting assumption of the vast majority of the work that has been done on trying to address the hierarchy problem over the last 40 plus years. However, there are reasons to believe that the rules of effective field theory might need to be extended to describe even the very low energy regime of theories that include gravity. So the idea that not all effective field theories that appear to be consistent will remain consistent when they are coupled to gravity goes back a long way, but it was made more concrete in this 2005 paper of Kunrun Bhafa, where he introduced this term of the swan plan. So this term refers to the idea that of all the effective field theories that are consistent QFTs, there will be a subset that remain consistent when coupled to gravity. And we refer to those as being part of the landscape of theories that can descend from a theory of quantum gravity, such as, for instance, a string theory. But there will be another subset of theories, which are those that do not remain consistent in the presence of gravity. And those are what we call the swan plant of effective field theories that cannot be UV completed into a quantum gravity theory. So intuition for this statement comes from a combination of formal research in a string theory over the last few decades and also some more general thought experiments involving black holes. So the goal is now to identify what are the consistency conditions that effective field theories need to satisfy in order to belong in the landscape, not the swan plant. And the hope is that those conditions will provide a powerful discriminating tool when applied to effective field theories. So some of the most well-known swan plant conditions include statements like there cannot be global symmetries in a theory of quantum gravity. Symmetries have to be either broken or gauged. The completeness hypothesis, so this means that all possible charge objects allowed by the Dirac quantization condition must be dynamically realized. This would mean, for example, that there must exist magnetic monopoles. The statement that charge has to be quantized, something called the weak gravity conjecture that I am going to tell you a bit more about in a minute, and so on. So this is not a complete list, and it is important to emphasize that most of these conditions remain conjectures with very few exceptions. But what I'm going to tell you about is not about how these conjectures are derived or proved, but rather what interests me is whether these conjectures and the swan plant program more generally can somehow inform our quest for physics beyond the standard model. So, let me tell you a little bit about...
Can I break in with a question?
Yes, please.
So since it sounds like you're going to rely on the swan plant conjecture, one thing that you know, because as you say, most of them are conjectures. One question is, you know, you in your earlier slide, you kind of laid out very clearly the assertion, right? The assertion is that there exist effective field theories for which there are no UV completions. what's the best evidence that that's a true thing? I mean, so if you just kind of say, if I'm trying to assess the value of these swampland things, one way to approach that is to say, we know a lot about effective field theories. What's the best example of something which would point in this direction?
Well, so here I gave you a list of a certain number of, you know, what we call swampland conjectures, but there is actually even a previous one that is not even a conjecture, it's just true, which is the existence of gravitational anomalies. So for example, in the absence of gravity, any quantum field theory that is free of gauge anomalies is a consistent quantum field theory. The moment I include gravity, there is an additional condition that I need to impose for consistency, which is that the theory does not have a gravitational anomaly or a mixed gauge gravitational anomaly. So I would say that, for example, is the very first swampland conjecture of all. And that is something that affects the infrared field content of field theories.
But why is that a swampland conjecture? Because why isn't that just a special case of the gauge, that if you have gauge degrees of freedom, they have to be anomaly free?
Well, so, I would call it swampland in the sense that, you know, it is a requirement that you need to ask of your theory for consistency only when gravity is part of the picture, right? Only when M Planck is finite, that your theory would be inconsistent if it had a gravitational anomaly. So in that loose sense, I think that sort of qualifies morally as one of the very first conditions.
I don't see that in the sense that's the same thing is true for electromagnetism. If I, you know, if I turn off the electric couplings, then I don't have a problem. But it's, I guess, of all these examples, you know, for example, the global symmetry one, that seems like that's very plausibly a consequence of string theory, that you're not going to have theories of global symmetries. But in practice, if you gave me, you know, there's nothing that says you can't have accidental global symmetries. So if you actually say, if you give me effective field theories that have global symmetries in them, do I know that they're going to not complete? You don't, because you don't know that it's just some accidental thing, right? So all the examples that you've mentioned so far seem to have the character that in the effective theory, if it's sick, I can see that it's sick. And in the full theory, if it's sick, I can see it's sick. But there's not an example of an effective theory which actually looks like it's not sick, which then can't be completed to a full theory which is not sick.
Well, so what I would say is that indeed, so for example, in particular, you know, the global symmetry statements, we have evidence for it in the sense that, you know, all sort of gravitational UV completions, we know none of them have global symmetries. And similarly, you know, we can get some intuition for these type of ideas from, you know, black hole thought experiments. But I think the core of what you are alluding to is the fact that we can indeed have in the IR something that looks very much like a global symmetry, something that is like an accidental approximate global symmetry. And I think the challenge is then, one of the challenges would then be to be able to assess like quantitatively, you know, how close to a global symmetry can we get in at low energies, right? Without, you know, fully breaking the rules, without falling into the swampland. So I completely agree that those are good questions. And, you know, those are questions that require answers. And I think part of those answers are going to come from a better formal understanding of where all of these conjectures actually come from and, you know, perhaps finding some sort of proof of them. There's another way to approach this, which is more what I've been focused on and what I'm going to discuss here, which is forget about you know, why these conjectures are true. If some of these conjectures for which there are or there is some, you know, some amount of evidence, if some of those are true and some of those allow us to have a new perspective or a new approach to some of the problems of the standard model, can we pursue that idea experimentally? And what type of signatures will we be looking for? So this is the approach that I am going to discuss here. And regardless of the details of exactly, you know, what is the form of the conjecture that is really satisfied or not, I think there is value in this program in particular because it gives you a way of concretely implement, you know, ideas to solve those problems of the standard model and really go after them with experiments we have.
But would you agree given that motivation that the criterion that should sort this list should be that if there's a problem in the low energies, it's something which you shouldn't be able to just fix it. You know, like just below the Planck mass. It has to be something which really should persist at very low energies to be relevant to the problems of the standard model. Yeah. And the things on your list don't do that, right? It's kind of a swamplementarity story that the more robust the plausibility is that you've got a real prediction of high energy theories, like they don't have global symmetries, the less predictive they are at low energies, it seems.
That is true, but I think that really comes down to, you know, things we don't yet know, which is, you know, we don't really know exactly how much gravity violates global symmetries, right? And so I think, you know, part of the challenge for this program is to make all of these conjectures, all of these conditions, quantitatively sharper in terms of what they actually mean for the physics at low energies, not just in the UV.
Yes. Let me ask a question here. I may have mentioned this to you before, but this is always puzzling me. It's a theorem of classical general relativity going back to the 1970s that on a spatially compact configuration space of general relativity coupled to anything, there are no global symmetries. And that's a formal statement which is proved by proving that there are no Killing fields or no conformal Killing fields on that configuration space. So that's already a result in classical general relativity. So I'm not surprised if we expect that that should be true of a good quantum theory of gravity.
I mean, I agree with that statement. And I think, you know, beyond that, I think, you know, the various black hole thought experiments about black hole decay gives some additional sort of intuition or perhaps, you know, circumstantial evidence for things like the no global symmetries or also the weak gravity conjecture.
But you can solve those all right below the Planck scale, right? You can just have some sort of an exotic thing that has the right quantum numbers.
You can indeed satisfy these conjectures by adding some, you know, charged particles, etc. What I'm going to focus on is can satisfying that conjecture in particular, I'm going to talk about the weak gravity conjecture, give you a new perspective of, in particular, the weak scale and what would that imply experimentally? Are there any signatures we can look for if that is true? So very much focusing on the interface between satisfying these conditions in whichever way they can be satisfied and whether that can interface in a non-trivial way with solving the problems of the standard model.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, again, so let me tell you now a little bit about this weak gravity conjecture. So in short, what the weak gravity conjecture says is that in any effective field theory that descends from a consistent theory of quantum gravity, gravity must be the weakest force. So for example, in a theory that contains gravity and electromagnetism, what the weak gravity conjecture implies is that since gravity has to be the weakest force, there must be a state in the theory with mass M and electric charge G such that the gravitational attraction between two of those particles is weaker than the electromagnetic repulsion between them. So this condition translates into an upper bound on the mass of an electrically charged particle that is given by its electric charge G times M Planck. And this upper bound on the mass of an electrically charged particle is often the way in which the weak gravity conjecture is formulated. Now, notice crucially that this bound disappears as we turn off gravity. So as we take M Planck to infinity or equivalently G Newton to zero, this bound goes away. So in the absence of gravity, we are free to consider any combination of mass and charge that we like. It is only when we try to make gravity part of the picture that a non-trivial constraint appears. And as I said before, motivation for the conjecture comes from both black hole thought experiments as well as the absence of counterexamples to these conjectures in all known string constructions. So to see what this means in practice, let's go back to our previous example where we were looking at electromagnetism with one massive charge fermion. And let's say that the only other ingredient is that the system is now coupled to gravity. So as per our previous discussion, we would naively think that an effective description of this theory in terms of QED plus a charge fermion is a perfectly good, a perfectly valid effective field theory up to energy scales of order the Planck scale. So long as the mass of our fermion lies below the Planck scale and that the values of our gauge coupling are small enough to be perturbative, then we are free to consider any combination again of mass and charge in this region. However, what the weak gravity conjecture seems to be telling us is that all the effective field theories that are in this blue region here, where the mass of our fermion exceeds the weak gravity conjecture bound, so where the mass is larger than its charge times the Planck scale, all of those effective field theories actually belong in the swampland of theories that cannot be UV completed into a theory of quantum gravity. So in this way, swampland considerations, in particular here, the weak gravity conjecture can impose significant extra restrictions on effective field theories that are not accessible within the effective field theory framework alone. So this goes morally against this idea of decoupling, that UV effects should decouple from IR dynamics, that is so central to the framework of effective field theory. So some of the work that I've done in recent times has been focused on trying to use some of these conditions, especially the weak gravity conjecture, to try and address some of the puzzles of the standard model. In particular, in this paper, the weak scale from weak gravity that I wrote recently with my collaborators, we show that the weak gravity conjecture could in fact be behind the hierarchy of scales that we observe between the weak scale and the Planck scale. So in order for this idea to work, the standard model needs to be extended to include a very weak extra force, so a much weaker version of electromagnetism. And there needs to be a particle that is charged under this force that gets at least some of its mass from the Higgs, so from electroweak symmetry breaking. So the idea is that if the weak gravity conjecture imposes an upper bound on the mass of this particle and some of its mass comes from the weak scale, then the weak gravity conjecture will translate into a bound on the size of the weak scale itself. So let me just explain this with a toy model. Let's say we have a complex scalar field phi that interacts with this fermion psi with a Yukawa coupling like this, with some strength that I'm going to call y here. So if this scalar field gets a vacuum expectation value, then this Yukawa term will generate a mass term for psi that is given by y times the VEF. Now, if this fermion is charged under a U1 gate symmetry and carries again electric charge G, then the weak gravity conjecture imposes a bound on the mass of this particle as given by G times M Planck. So this will directly translate into an upper bound on the VEF, on the vacuum expectation value of this scalar field. So the weak gravity conjecture can set an upper bound on the ratio between the scalar vacuum expectation value and the Planck scale in terms of a ratio between a gauge coupling and, in this example, the Yukawa coupling between the scalar and the fermion. Now, for the weak gravity conjecture to explain why the ratio of the weak scale to the Planck scale is tiny, this requires very small values of these electric gauge coupling. In particular, to explain the size of the weak scale, this new gauge coupling would need to be no larger than 10 to the minus 16, which is indeed a very small number. However, unlike the mass of a scalar field, or equivalently its vacuum expectation value, a gauge coupling is a parameter that is largely insensitive to the dynamics in the UV. So this qualitatively changes the nature of the question we're asking and allows us to address the hierarchy problem not by complying with the expectations of effective field theory, but rather by violating what those expectations are. And I should emphasize that implementing this idea to actually explain the size of the weak scale in the standard model necessarily requires introducing a new gauge force and new particles beyond those we have in the standard model. So introducing new particles that interact with the Higgs so as to get some of their mass from electroweak symmetry breaking immediately implies that there are already some experimental constraints on this idea. And this is what I'm showing you here in this plot. So this x-axis corresponds to the mass of this new extra particle that satisfies the weak gravity conjecture. The y-axis roughly corresponds to the effective coupling between this new particle and the Higgs. So these two dashed lines here indicate the fraction of the mass of the weak gravity conjecture particle that comes from electroweak symmetry breaking. So delta equals 1 means another one fraction, delta equals 10 means 1 part in 10, and so on. So this idea works better when this number is order one, so roughly between these two dashed lines. So when the mass of the weak gravity conjecture particle is below half the Higgs mass, then it is possible for the Higgs to decay into two of these particles. And this is what we call a Higgs to invisible decay, because we wouldn't be able to see these particles at colliders. And this is a possibility that is already experimentally constrained. So the dark blue region here in this plot corresponds to the current bound on the Higgs to invisible branching ratio, which currently is on the order of 20%. And the light blue region corresponds to how much that measurement is going to improve by the end of the LHC. And then in the regime of heavy masses, the leading constraint comes from precise measurements of electroweak precision parameters in the standard model.
Isabel, can I ask you something regarding the inequality you showed in your previous slide? You can satisfy the weak gravity conjecture by making the VEV heavier and the Yukawa smaller. Because the constraint, so basically here you have, I can make, if I make G, you say 10 to the minus 16, but I can make Yukawa 10 to the minus 16 too. So then the mass is still small, this is satisfied, but the VEV is at the Planck scale.
Yes, so this is a constraint again that, so the idea is that what you are doing is you are using the weak gravity conjecture to set a bound on a parameter that is UV sensitive through some parameters that are largely insensitive to the UV, which are what we call technically natural. And I agree that, you know, we have to choose the values of these parameters, but this is no different from what we do in any other solution to the electroweak hierarchy problem. I would say that the very first step in solving the hierarchy problem is translating, the Higgs VEV, which again is a UV sensitive parameter, into another parameter that is technically natural. So for example, when we do low scale supersymmetry to solve the hierarchy problem, mm-hmm. Having supersymmetry at the TV scale, we agree that, you know, you've solved the hierarchy problem, but the ratio of the Susie breaking scale to M Planck, that number is 10 to the minus 16. Okay.
But that
is a technically natural parameter. It's largely insensitive to UV corrections. And we fix that number to be whatever it has to be in order to solve the hierarchy problem. So I claim in that sense that it's no different. I completely agree that, for example, in this toy model, this is a two-parameter space with a gauge coupling and a Yukawa coupling. There are regions of that parameter space where you don't solve the hierarchy problem through the weak gravity conjecture. There are regions where you do. But that is no different from having supersymmetry broken, depending on which scale is broken.
Yeah, but then, I mean, in Susie case, for example, you can explain the scale of Susie breaking with dimensional transmutation. So effectively, you have actually some order one numbers that does not require an artificially small parameter in the theory. So here, what explains the small the Yukawa? I mean, you have a small gauge coupling. Why can't the Yukawa be small?
The Yukawa could be small, even if it's not a small, even if it's an order one number, you still need to explain why the gauge coupling, I would say more urgently, has to be this small. And I agree that in order to fully solve the hierarchy problem, you would need to explain why this technically natural parameter is small. Again, that is no different from explaining why the Susie breaking scale is parametrically below M Planck. But I agree that would be a question for the further UV completion. But I think is it still, you know, just is it still a further step in the sense that you've translated, you know, a parameter that is quadratically sensitive to the UV into one that is not?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So the bottom line that I wanted to express with this is that there are some well-motivated regions of this parameter space where this idea works that are already being experimentally probed. So if the Will-Gabbert conjecture indeed plays a role in stabilizing the weak scale, then there are certain experimental signatures that we can look for to see whether this idea is at play. However, the real telltale sign that the Will-Gabbert conjecture is at play is that the Will-Gabbert conjecture particle is charged under this extremely weak new force. But with the values of the new gauge coupling that we are considering, as I said earlier, this new gauge coupling has to be 10 to the minus 16 or smaller. It looks like it would be extremely hard to confirm that indeed the Will-Gabbert conjecture is behind the weak scale. Which brings me to the second part of my talk, the importance of exploring connections between the different puzzles. So a solution to the hierarchy problem that is based on the Will-Gabbert conjecture, as I've just discussed, this necessarily introduces a new stabilizing symmetry, which is precisely the U1 gauge symmetry. So the lightest particle that is charged under this new U1 will then be stable and therefore provides a potential dark matter candidate. And in this context, cosmological considerations can then provide additional information. So if a weak gravity conjecture particle is the dark matter, which is possible in the various implementations of this idea that we discuss in our paper, then this means that the dark matter will self-interact through a very weak but nevertheless long-range force. So in this context, the dark matter will behave like a plasma, so collective effects will dominate over nearest neighbor interactions, and this can lead to important effects on large scales, such as, for example, the scales that are relevant for the dynamics of galaxy clusters. So the idea here is that when two galaxy clusters collide, these can trigger instabilities in the dark matter plasma. If these instabilities grow large enough, then the dark matter will become effectively collisional on very large scales. And in a picture of a galaxy cluster collision, this could change the distribution of the dark matter. So in these cases, the typical timescale for instabilities to grow is set by the corresponding plasma frequency, which in general is given by this expression. If the particle in the plasma roughly saturates the Will-Gabbert conjecture bound, then the plasma frequency will only depend on the energy density of the plasma, which in this case is just the dark matter energy density. So for instance, for dark matter energy densities, such as those that we see in galaxy clusters, the time scale defined by the plasma frequency can be on the order of 10 to the 15 seconds. So this seems like a very long time, but in fact, it is comparable with the typical time scale of galaxy cluster collisions. So the dark matter dynamics can give us complementary signatures that we can at least look for that are different from those related to the Higgs sector. And in this case, in particular, it would provide us with evidence for the presence of this new very weak extra force, which would be the real sign that the Will-Gabbert conjecture is at play. Now, forget about the Will-Gabbert conjecture for a second and forget about the swampland. It is, in fact, a common occurrence that theories that try to address the dynamics behind the weak scale by introducing new symmetries and a new field content typically feature potential dark matter candidates. So the best well-known example that I'm sure you have all heard about.
Can I ask you a question before you? Are you moving on from the previous topic with the clusters? Or?
I am moving on from this. Yeah.
So can I ask you, so what is it actually that we should be looking for? Because of course, I mean, mergers of, I guess, dark matter halos or clusters is already a chaotic process. So what should we be looking for?
Yeah, so for example, the typical signature that, you know, you've had some type of instability is, so when you have your usual picture of the Bully cluster, for example, you see sort of like the dark matter clouds staying sort of almost independent of the collision that took place, whereas the standard model, you see, for example, you know, the shape of shock waves having developed in the because of the plasma of electrons, et cetera, you have. So if dark matter itself was a plasma, the dark matter cloud should behave a little bit like, you know, what happens with the standard model. So not as much, obviously, it is ruled out that the dark matter is a plasma with a gauge coupling as large as electromagnetism, but depending on the value of that gauge coupling, your distribution of dark matter should show certain features.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so as I said, the best well-known example of this that you've all heard many times are weakly interacting massive particles, for example, in theories of supersymmetry, where the relic abundance of the dark matter is set by the freeze-out of dark matter annihilations in the early universe. So identifying successful models of dark matter in the context of theories that address the electroweak hierarchy problem is a theme that has always been present in my work. For example, in these two papers of mine, we identify models of dark matter in the context of theories of so-called neutral naturalness, including a very attractive implementation of asymmetric dark matter, which to my mind is the most attractive framework to produce dark matter in the early universe. So unfortunately, I don't have time to discuss this today, but I'll be happy to talk more about it and answer any questions if you're talking to me afterwards or on Monday. Okay, so on this note, let me move on to the last part of my talk, which is about the importance of exploring all possible ways to probe our ideas. And I am going to discuss this first in the context of the strong CP problem. Many of you may not be extremely familiar with the strong CP problem, so let me introduce it for you first. So as I said at the beginning of my talk, the gauge group, the gauge structure of the standard model is based on the group SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And we've talked about the electroweak part a little bit when discussing the electroweak hierarchy problem. Instead, the strong CP problem has to do with the SU3 part, the factor responsible for the strong interactions, and in particular, the fact that it has a non-trivial homotopic structure. So what this means in practice is that there is an additional parameter that we normally call theta bar that characterizes the vacuum of our theory. So this is an angular parameter again, and in principle, it could take any value from 0 to 2 pi. So something that is crucial is that theta bar provides a physical measurement of both parity and CP violation in the strong sector of the standard model. So there are a number of physical quantities that depend on theta bar. The one that is most useful in terms of probing the value of the QCD vacuum angle experimentally is the electric dipole moment of the neutron. The theoretical prediction for the neutron EDM is proportional to theta bar, and it is given by this expression in the appropriate units. So experimentally, we had not observed a neutron EDM. All we have currently is this upper bound, which in turn constrains the value of theta bar to be smaller than around 10 to the minus 10. So the QCD vacuum angle in the standard model needs to be incredibly, incredibly small. And this is a problem or a puzzle for the following reasons. So in the standard model, the QCD vacuum angle receives contributions from two different sources. On the one hand, from the coefficient of the topological operator involving the QCD field strengths, and on the other hand, from the argument of the determinant of the quark mass matrix. Now, we know in particular that the quark mass matrix has to be complex, and we know that because that is a requirement for there to be CP violation in the electroweak sector of the standard model. And we've known for a long time that the weak interactions do violate CP because we've measured the phase in the CKA matrix to be not only zero, not only non-zero, but actually order one. And in fact, it is both CP and also parity that are maximally violated by the electroweak sector of the standard model. So this brings us to the essence of the strong CP problem, which is that it is not possible to understand the smallness of the QCD vacuum angle based only on the underlying symmetries of the standard model. If we want to explain why theta bar is so small, we need either a dynamical mechanism or some additional symmetry structure beyond what we have in the standard model. So what has traditionally been the most popular mechanism to solve the strong CP problem is the so-called QCD axiom. In this context, theta bar is not just a parameter. It gets promoted to the status of a dynamical field, the axion, which is a pseudonymous Goldstone of a spontaneously broken U1 global symmetry that we call U1PQ for Petchequin. And crucially, that U1 symmetry must also be broken explicitly by QCD. So being a pseudoscalar, the axion can couple to the QCD field strength in this way. In turn, QCD dynamics generate a potential for the axion that is periodic and has a minimum for a value of the axion vacuum expectation value such that the effective QCD vacuum angle completely vanishes, therefore solving the strong CP problem. And this idea was developed in the late 70s by a combination of authors, most notably Petch and Queen, but also later on by people like Fran Wilczek and Steve Weber. So on the face of it, this is a very minimal and elegant solution to the strong CP problem, and a huge amount of experimental effort has gone quite correctly into probing the axion paradigm. However, it has one important flaw, which is that in order to really work, this mechanism must be such that the breaking of the U1PQ symmetry by QCD, and therefore the generated action potential, must dominate to one part in 10 to the 10 over any other contribution coming from additional degrees of freedom. And this is a bit of a problem because, as I told you earlier on in my talk, we expect that quantum gravity will violate all global symmetries. This is, again, one of the most well-established conjectures, if you want, in the Swampland program. So the violation of the U1PQ symmetry by gravity will generate a potential for the axion that, in turn, will move the theory away from the vacuum of vanishing theta bar. So, for example, if we consider the leading higher dimensional operator that violates the U1PQ symmetry, so phi here is the Petchequin field, the face of which is the axion, and then in order not to spoil the solution to the strong CP problem, the coefficient of this operator would need to be incredibly, incredibly small. In other words, we say that the PQ symmetry needs to be a very high quality global symmetry, which is somewhat in tension with the breaking of global symmetries we expect in the context of a gravitational UV completion. So to my mind, this certainly motivates taking seriously considering alternative solutions to the strong CP problem that may be on better terms with the expectation that there can be no global symmetry. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about solutions to the strong CP problem that are based on restoring parity symmetry. So I told you earlier that a non-zero QCD vacuum angle violates both parity and CP. So
before you start this, can I ask you a question about the previous slide?
Yes.
So the story you're telling about the global symmetries there, you know, in the way axions often arise in string theory is as Kalber-Mohn kind of fields, anti-symmetric gauge fields. Is there a similar issue if the axion arises in that way? Do you have a higher dimensional operator that can't be, has to have a small coefficient?
So this problem of the U1PQ symmetry having to be a very high quality global symmetry, you know, the way I'm parameterizing here is through the coefficient of this high dimensional operator being very small. This problem can be solved. And for instance, there are two things I would like to say. One is the action quality problem can be solved, and the PQ symmetry can be made a very approximate global symmetry. From the bottom up, that certainly comes at the expense of minimality, which is sometimes, you know, advertised as one of the most attractive features of the QCD axion. But it is true that it is possible to, in the context of a string theory, it is possible to arrange for the U1 PQ symmetry to remain an approximate global symmetry. This certainly imposes constraints on string theory model building, in the sense that if you see it in some part of the string landscape where the U1 PQ symmetry remains a very approximate global symmetry, then you certainly expect all other global symmetries to also remain approximate to a high degree. So this is something that it goes by the name of the string axiverse, that in those circumstances, you don't only expect to have the QCD axion, you in fact expect a very very many other particles with the qualitative properties of the QCD axion. So it is possible to solve the axion quality problem, in particular in the context of string theory. But the fact that, you know, we've discovered neither the QCD axion nor any of those other axiverse axions, I think it certainly at least motivates considering other possibilities to solve the strong CP problem that may not require gravity to sort of preserve global symmetries to this exceptional degree.
So I accept that you can solve the problem. I'm trying to understand. This is kind of an information question for me. Is that if I was building models with starting from an anti-symmetric tensor field coming from string theory or something, do these issues of higher dimensional operators arise there? Is the question?
Well, so I think there is a qualitative distinction, right, on whether the U1 symmetry we are talking about is a global symmetry or is a gauge symmetry. Obviously, if that symmetry is really in the UV secretly a gauge symmetry, then it cannot be explicitly broken. Therefore, you should not be writing down higher dimensional operators that explicitly violate the symmetry. Those are never going to be generated. But the U1 PQ symmetry cannot be a gauge symmetry, okay? If it was a gauge symmetry that is spontaneously broken, then you would no longer have an axion.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so let me move on. I'm going to go a little bit over time, but I hope that's okay because there have been some questions. So hopefully that counts as discussion.
Definitely, Isabel, definitely. Yes. Go ahead.
So solutions to the strong CP problem that are based on restoring parity symmetry. So I told you earlier that when theta bar is non-zero, that violates both parity and CP. So if either parity or CP are restored, then it is possible to solve the strong CP problem. And I want to emphasize that solutions to a strong CP that are based on restoring parity are different from those based on restoring CP. The latter go by the name of Nelson-Barr models that some of you may be more familiar with. I will not be talking about those here. So to restore parity symmetry and solve the strong CP problem, the gauge group of the standard model needs to be extended to include an additional SG2 factor that we normally call SG2 right. And similarly, the matter content needs to be extended to include effectively a mirror copy of both the Higgs and the fermion sectors of the standard model. So with this extended structure, it is possible to define a generalized version of parity that acts just like ordinary parity, but also interchanges the particles of the standard model and mirror sectors. And crucially, because there is a single SG3 gauge factor, the QCD vacuum angle remains odd under this generalized version of parity. So I will refer to this as parity, just as parity in going forward. Now, of course, even if the theory is parity symmetric, the vacuum in which we live is not. So ultimately, parity needs to be broken spontaneously so that all these mirror particles are heavy enough to have escaped experimental detection. Moreover, in order to really solve the Strong-CP problem, the parity breaking scale cannot be too high. So if it is too far above the weakest scale, then the theory, the scalar sector of the theory would be fine-tuned. And in that case, we would be introducing another parameter, another small number into the theory that is even smaller than the number that one tried to explain. So if we demand that the fine tuning is better than one part in 10 to the 10, then this means that the parity breaking scale must be below around 10 to the 7 GeV. So in this recent paper that I wrote with my collaborators at UCSB, and we discussed in detail the phenomenology of parity solutions to the Strong-CP problem. In particular, we showed that the scale of parity breaking can be as low as 18 TeV. And this is the result of a specific realization of the standard model fermion masses that goes by the name of the CISO mechanism and leads to a spectrum of exotic particles, which is of this form. So above the standard model, the lightest new particles are the W prime and C prime gauge bosons of the SU2 right factor, and mirror fermions that are charged under QCD only appear at higher scales, both at the scale of parity breaking and also at what we call the CISO scale, that is parametrically above V prime. As a result, the leading constraint on these models actually comes from the direct production of W prime and C prime gauge bosons at the LHC. This is an irreducible signature of parity solutions to the Strong-CP problem, and it makes collider experiments central in exploring this type of solutions to the Strong-CP problem. So I've been saying for a while now that parity needs to be spontaneously broken in these models, and one way to break parity spontaneously is through the VEF, through the vacuum expectation value of a pseudoscalar field. So if a pseudoscalar field that is odd under parity gets a vacuum expectation value, parity will be spontaneously broken. If this field also interacts with the Higgs sector of the theory, then this will translate into different BEVs for the Higgs of the mirror and the standard model sectors, which is what we need to make sure that the theory complies with experimental constraints. Now, regardless of the details of how exactly parity gets broken, it is always true that theories that have spontaneously broken discrete symmetries contain domain wall solutions. So domain walls are static, time-independent field configurations that interpolate between the different vacua that are related by the discrete symmetry. These objects are topologically stable when the discrete symmetry is global, and they are characterized by what we call the tension of the domain wall, which is the mass per unit area of this object, and it's parametrically set by the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now, the existence of domain walls has traditionally been considered a fatal problem in theories with spontaneously broken discrete symmetries. And that's because this class of topological defects can be formed in the early universe after reheating takes place. If that happens, because the energy density in domain walls redshifts more slowly than matter or radiation, then domain walls end up dominating the universe's energy density, and that leads to a subsequent evolution that is inconsistent with observation. However, this is no longer a problem if we again remember that we expect that quantum gravity will violate all global symmetry. So the breaking of parity due to gravitational effects breaks the degeneracy between the two vacua. So for example, this is the leading higher dimensional operator that breaks parity in the pseudoscalar sector. And I am writing here an overall coefficient, epsilon, that I'm using to parameterize how much gravity violates this global symmetry. So after a spontaneous symmetry breaking, this operator will lead to an energy difference between the two previously degenerate vacua, which is given by this expression here. So crucially, once the two vacua are no longer degenerate, any domain wall network that may have formed in the early universe now becomes unstable. And instead, the universe will evolve into the vacuum that has the smallest energy density. Now, when this happens, the collapse of the domain wall network can result in the emission of significant amounts of gravitational radiation that today we may be able to detect as a stochastic background of gravitational waves. So there are two main quantities that characterize this stochastic background, which are the peak frequency of the background, as well as the strength of the signal at that frequency peak. So the peak frequency of the gravitational wave signal is set by the typical radius of the domain walls at the time of collapse. Parametrically, this is just given by the corresponding Hubble scale, which during a radiation-dominated universe just goes like the time. On the other hand, the amount of energy density that goes into gravitational radiation is essentially just determined by the domain wall tension. So there is the mandatory power of G Newton and then the appropriate powers of the domain wall tension to make up for dimension. So the time at which the network of domain walls collapses is determined by the competition between the pressure difference between the two vacua, which are again no longer degenerate, and the tension of the domain wall. So parametrically, the time of collapse is given by the ratio of these two quantities. In particular, notice that the smaller epsilon, so the more high quality parity remains as a global symmetry, the later the network of domain walls will collapse, and therefore the peak frequency of a gravitational wave signal will be smaller and smaller. On the other hand, the strength of the signal as we see it today will get larger because there is less redshift between the time of emission and today. So this is what I'm showing you here in this plot. This x-axis corresponds to the peak frequency of the gravitational wave signal. Y-axis is the energy density in gravitational radiation today at that peak frequency. And as usual, this is normalized to the critical energy density. So this blue region corresponds to the region where the peak of the stochastic background could fall. In particular, the region between these two dashed lines is where the scale of a spontaneous symmetry breaking, the scale of parity breaking, is low enough that the parity solutions we've been discussing successfully address solve the Strong-CP problem. And these very thin dotted lines correspond to constant values of epsilon. Remember, epsilon is the coefficient we're using to parameterize the explicit breaking of parity due to gravity. So there is some region of the relevant parameter space where this theory solves the Strong-CP problem, where the gravitational wave signal falls within the reach of current and future gravitational wave observatories, in particular, those that are exploring the very low frequency regime, so from 10 to the minus 9 to 10 to the minus 6 hertz. So this is my last slide before the conclusions. One of the original motivations to consider solutions to the Strong-CP problem that are different from the QCD axion, as I said, was that the U1PQ symmetry had to remain a very high quality global symmetry in any UV completion. By contrast, parity can easily be broken without spoiling the solution to a Strong-CP. So for example, the leading higher dimensional operators that break parity and lead to a direct contribution to theta bar look like this. So these are dimension 5 and are suppressed again by a single power of M Planck. When the Higgses in both sectors get their BEVs, these operators lead to a contribution to theta bar that is of this form. And demanding that this stays below the experimental upper bound of 10 to the minus 10 means that the parity breaking scale must be below 20 TeV, which is compatible with the lower bound on V prime I told you earlier, coming from the direct production of W prime and C prime gauge bosons at colliders, which is around 18 TeV at the moment. So even another one breaking of parity by gravitational effects won't spoil these solutions to the Strong-CP problem. However, these two quantities, these two numbers are very close to each other, which means that if gravity really maximally violates global symmetries, then the prediction for the neutron EDM would certainly be large enough to be observed in upcoming experiments. So these solutions to the strong CP problem are very robust against the breaking of global symmetries by gravity. And in fact, the mandatory violation of parity of global symmetries in a theory of quantum gravity, it is not so much a bug for these models. It is more, I would say, a feature that can highlight certain experimental opportunities, as we've seen, both for EDM experiments and also gravitational wave detectors. So let me just conclude. There are a variety of problems in the standard model that remain unsolved. But the main message that I want to get across in this talk is that formal developments in high energy theory, especially when it comes to progress in our understanding of how the standard model fits into a gravitational UV completion, that can provide us with a new perspective or completely perhaps new approaches to these various problems that are qualitatively different from those based on the framework of effective field theory. And crucially, in ways that we can pursue experimentally. And this comes at a time when we have more experiments available to us than ever before, from colliders to dark matter detectors to gravitational wave experiments. So to my mind, it is these theoretical developments combined with all the different experiments we have at our disposal that will provide us with the big breakthrough we need to move beyond the standard model. So for all these reasons combined, I think it is a very exciting time to be working in particle physics. So thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. Let's unmute and thank Isabel. So we've had questions, so we are also over time. So if people want to leave, they're welcome to. But at the same time, I would like to welcome questions from students if they have any. And you can just unmute yourselves now, because I cannot see whoever raises their hand. Okay, any other questions from anyone else in the audience?
I've got one if no one else is gonna say something. I got one more. So this is just a really, it's kind of a, it's one of those, one of the selling points in the way you're presenting things is that gravity could step outside of the effective field theory framework. And so one of the things that to me says is that normally what's good about the effective field theory framework is it provides you with an understanding of theoretical errors when you make gravitational predictions. So when you're predicting things in inflation, or if you're predicting, predicting gravitational wave signals, we normally do semi-classical calculations, and then we're normally using decoupling to say that the corrections to those semi-classical calculations are, quantifiable and small. But if you step away, if you take the point of view that gravity is outside of this decoupling framework, how do you protect yourself from uncontrolled theoretical errors in all your gravitational observables?
I mean, that is a great question. And, the challenge really is to step aside from, the framework of effective field theory, while at the same time maintaining the great success that effective field theory, has provided us with in all the, not just cosmologically, but also, in all the other cases in which we've used effective field theory. So I would say, in particular, some of the examples I've discussed here, like, the weak gravity conjecture. So it is sort of like a halfway house, I would say, in which you are saying, well, gravity tells you your spectrum of charged particles cannot be, there's more to the consistency of your theory than what you can tell from effective field theory. But, perhaps just adding the right, charged particles below certain scales, that sort of takes care of, in particular, the weak gravity conjecture. And then you can continue using sort of effective field theory. So it's more, if you want, sort of like a halfway house, and it has to be like that precisely because of all the success, accrued success of the framework of effective field theory. But I think you know, this is certainly something that I think as the our understanding of how, you know, the Swampland program, and just more generally, you know, how gravity sort of affects the IR in various ways, you know, this is something that hopefully will just become much clearer. So, you know, right now, one very unsatisfying aspect to my mind of the Swampland program is that I can give you this list of conjectures, but at the end of the day, you know, the goal should be to find out, you know, what are the consistency conditions why all of those conjectures arise? Where is all of this coming from? And hopefully that will also tell us, that will also give a good answer to the question you're asking ultimately, I think.
Right. Okay, thank you. Pretty nice talk.
Thanks.
Anyone else?
So can I ask you, so regarding the solutions of the strong CP problem with parity, what will you need to discover that? And is there any discovery potential at the high Lumi, or consistent with current bounds, there's no discovery potential?
Well, so I think, let me go back to this slide. So right now, the current bound, again, from this is just direct production at the LHC on W prime masses in particular, is like 6 TeV. By the end of LHC, this bound is going to go all the way up to 40 TeV. So this will probe this class of theories up to a level of fine tuning in the scalar potential, which is 10 to the minus 5. And I would call it a day. I would say, you know, the LHC is certainly going to probe basically another one region where these theories remain at least attractive solutions to the strong CP problem. I mean, it's still true that, of course, you know, parity can still be spontaneously broken at any scale, but as it pertains to its ability to solve the strong CP problem, I think this is, you know, this will definitely be, these bounds are going to improve in the future.
And you could get a 5 sigma discovery at the high domain.
Yeah, I mean, it depends, again, you know, if you don't, then what it means is that these models have to be more fine-tuned, but the more fine-tuned they are, the worse solutions to the strong CP problem they are also, right? So yeah, you could.
Great, thank you.
Talking about fine tuning, so how tuned is this? Because the Higgs would want to be at 18 TeV, right?
The Higgs would want to be at the scale V prime. So at the moment, you know, the fine tuning is sort of around 1 in 10 to the 3. So it is not fully natural. It is certainly better than 10 to the minus 10.
Okay, going back to that, there is also the secret parameter epsilon that you wrote. Shouldn't be multiplying the epsilon parameter with a 10 to the minus 3 to get the full tuning of the theory.
So sorry, what epsilon parameter?
The higher dimension operator you wrote down to get rid of the domain walls. You had to make that small in order to, I mean...
Well, not really. So there are various, I've discussed sort of various higher dimensional operators that break parity. One was crucially... you know, these higher dimensional operators that give you a direct contribution to theta bar. And in making this estimate, I was just putting these guys to be order one, okay?
Yeah, but then what about the other, the phi to the fifth?
So this one, the phi to the fifth, this can be also order one. If this is order one, as you see in this plot, you know, this is, the problem is, well, it's not a problem. I mean, there is some, you know, parameter space in terms of what epsilon is, what the scale of parity breaking is.
Yeah.
If epsilon is order one, what happens is that these two vacua are, you know, very non-degenerate. And what happens is that basically the moment they form, they also collapse.
And doesn't that also spoil the theta solution?
Not directly.
Okay.
Because, so there is another high dimensional operator that I didn't discuss that I also give you a leading contribution to theta bar, which is phi GG dual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that only tells you that V prime needs to be below around 10 to the 8 GV, 10 to the 8 GV, 10 to the 7 GV. That is a much weaker bound on, even if that was order one, you know, these are the operators that I give you the lowest sort of upper bound on V prime. What will happen is that, you know, if the coefficient of this operator was order one, then as I said, the domain walls would disappear almost after they are formed, because mm-hmm. that is happening at temperatures of order V prime, then the gravitational wave signal would just not be observable. So it is only in, you know, it's only when the domain walls lived for a while and they, you know, they decay late enough that you have a chance of seeing something like this. So it is certainly not in the entire, you know, parameter space that you would see this. It is in some, you know, depending on how this, again, how this higher dimensional operator is, you know, is realized, then you could or you could not get a gravitational wave signal. But all the one coefficients for all the high dimensional operators that break parity are perfectly consistent with all, you know, all experimental constraints.
Okay. Okay, good. Thank you. Let's stop here. Actually, let's thank Isabel again because you have finished up the recording.